morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case today is Gingold versus Life Insurance Company. Fine.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Arthur Klein, and I am representing plaintiff Dan Gingold in this ERISA claim, or ERISA case, against Unum Insurance Company. As Your Honors are aware, the nub of this case is a denial of benefits, substantial amount of benefits, by Unum to Mr. Gingold, who had been the chief executive officer and principal shareholder of a company called Accurate Dye and Stamping. The test, and I don't think there's any question about the test, is the so-called arbitrary and capricious standard. And while the plan administrator or carrier is entitled to a great deal of discretion under this standard, it is our opinion, with all due respect to the district court, that this is a situation where the arbitrary and capricious standard was breached, and what Unum did, in our view, was clearly wrong. Under the law of this circuit, and I think several others, one of the tests for the arbitrary and capricious standard is whether the plan or policy is modified, or whether the carrier applies it in a way that contravenes the plain meaning. It's not a rubber stamp. The law is pretty clear. The discretion is not unfettered, and we believe that modification was clearly what occurred here. Mr. Gingold's company applied for disability benefits, and as I said, he was the chief executive officer and the principal shareholder of the company. At the time he applied, or they applied for the policy, and thereafter, he had elected to designate his monthly income in two different ways. Approximately, it totaled $115,000 a year. He elected to designate $84,000 of it as salary, and in an effort to minimize his Social Security and Medicare taxes, he designated approximately $31,000 a year as rental income. He did own the building the company operated out of. He did, of course, care for the building, pay taxes on the building, be that as it may for now. The policy definition of monthly earnings, which is the test for disability, is defined in two different ways, which are very similar. One is gross monthly income from your employer, and the other is total income before taxes. With all due respect, and there are a number of exclusions thereafter, with all due respect again to the district court, it seems to us very clear, although obviously the district court disagreed, that gross monthly income from your employer and total income before taxes is clearly unambiguous, and it clearly includes that portion of his income that he elected to designate as rental income. Bear in mind, and later on, of course, Union and our judgment narrowed that definition in three different ways, that at the time the policy was issued, Mr. Gingold, of course, read the definition and had the option, obviously, of had the definition been something different, to change the way he designated his salary. Had the definition read, as Unum later contended, that monthly income, monthly earnings, pardon me, was only salary, or was only income, only numbers reflected on a W-2 form, or only compensation directly for services rendered, then obviously he would have faced a dilemma, and might well, and probably would have, because he obviously intended to protect his entire $115,000 for his family, change the designation. But he didn't. He relied on what appeared to be a very clear and unambiguous definition and went on. And 5 years later, well, one other point I should mention before we go on. The Newnham application papers call for two different numbers. They ask the applicant, in this case, Acura, to list total income and salary, two different figures. And of course, in this case, they listed Mr. Dingell's total income as $115,000 and his salary at $84,000. I think it's very significant that the premiums were calculated not only on the salary, and not on the salary at all, but on the higher $115,000 total income figure. That is what they calculated, that's what they charged the premiums on, and that's what they collected until Mr. Dingell became totally disabled 5 years later and applied for his claim. There is no dispute that Mr. Dingell became totally disabled. There is no dispute that he submitted his claim. And there is no dispute that Newnham denied and refused to pay any part of the benefits based upon the rental income. They took the position that the definition, in our judgment, and I don't mean to overstate, I'm sorry if I do, that the definition, which again I believe is unambiguous, clear, gross monthly income from your employer or total income before taxes, they took three different positions. They said, well, it doesn't really mean that. It means only your salary. Then they used another constriction, only compensation for services rendered, and then finally they said, well, it means only numbers shown on your W-2 form. Now, I think you could probably argue, and I don't mean to be hyper-technical, that the rental income in substance was salary, it was compensation for services rendered, but it of course was not listed on his W-2 form, and that was the entire point. And throughout a lengthy series of appeals, both pro se and with an attorney, Newnham never changed its position and refused to pay benefits on the entirety of Mr. Dingell's income. That's why we are here today. The district court, unfortunately, took the position, and obviously we disagreed with the district court, that the definition was incomplete, or I think that was not trying to blur the words he used. He felt the definition was not unambiguous, obviously, which we think is clearly wrong, and gave them the deference to interpret it. It is very difficult, with all due respect to the district court, to understand how we could have reached that conclusion. This is not an ambiguity.
You're on the rebuttal side, you know.
In that case, I will sit down, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. McMahon? Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel.
Before you take off, where your opponent put himself in, you charged the premium on $115,000, am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Were you aware at the time you set the premium figure that part of the $115,000 was rental?
I don't believe that was ever determined. What the $115,000 was submitted by an employee, the president of the company, and I believe Judge Aston's opinion referred to that.
My question is, what he said was that you were asked two figures, and he gave the gross figure 115, but then he showed the salary is $84,000 some odd. Did anybody be curious as to where the rest of the money, why the rest of the money was coming from this?
They did not during the application process, Your Honor. We relied upon the information provided by the employer.
And the information was, as I described it, the salary was $84,000 some and the rest was from another source. Did it show the source that it was from that?
I don't believe it did, Your Honor. I believe it just showed the $115,000 for that. But keep in mind, Your Honor.
In some way, you asked for two figures.
At some point, we learned that he separated out $84,115. I believe during the application process, there was a listing wherein the employer listed all of the employees' salaries. And Mr. Gingold, on that form, was listed as
$115,000.
There's no breakdown. I don't believe so. It's just a number. And that's the number that we would...
What portion he was talking about when he said he asked for two figures?
Except during the claim process.
Oh, he said before that.
We separated it out. No, I don't, actually. I think it was, there was a listing that had the 115.
So, at the time of the claim, your company was well aware of the fact that part of the $115,000 was rental income.
I can tell you, Your Honor, this might be what he's referring to. Let me just see if this says $84,000. There was an employment and education history that was submitted.
This is prior to the issuance of the policy.
And I don't think that shows a...
Did you get my question? Was this submitted prior to the issuance of the policy?
No, Your Honor, I believe the number they had prior to the policy was the 115.
And that's all?
I believe so.
That would be significant, wouldn't it? If you're aware of what the income was predicated on when you issued the policy, it would make a difference, wouldn't it?
I believe it does not even make a difference, Your Honor, because the amount of benefits is determined at the time of claim. And oftentimes in policies, we can receive numbers from employers that change over the years, that can be incorrect. What we do is at the time of claim, and the policy itself specifies that you examine the basic monthly earnings at the time of claim, not at the time 5 years ago.
The company writing the policy, setting the figure of 115, which you did, to collect the premium. If you were aware of the $115,000 in claim to rental, that wouldn't affect the outcome of this proceeding at all?
Well, what happened, Your Honor?
That's not my question. One more time. If you were aware at the time you issued the policy that it was for $115,000, you were also aware that that was broken into salary and rental income. Would that affect the outcome of these proceedings?
No, Your Honor. I believe that under that circumstance, exactly what Unum did is the proper procedure, and that's offered to return the overpaid premium.
Why until there is a claim, assuming there will be a claim, and then the debt says to you, and I said, ha!
Well, we have to
know about it, but you can't do it. Well, you did rely on it. That's what I'm asking. You gave me the two figures that if you did. And then so you based your plan and you issued the policy on it at the 115 level.
But I still do not believe that changes the evaluation, Your Honor, because the evaluation is at the time of the claim. What is the salary at the time of the claim? I mean, presumably, that number could have gone up even higher. I mean, maybe at some point at the time of the claim, he could have been earning $300,000.
Mm.
And the evaluation is still at the time of claim. Mm. And he would have essentially underpaid his premium. That's not the issue here, Your Honor.
Would you have paid full amount? Would the salary have gone up to say $200,000, you would pay the full amount?
We would have paid the 66 2/3% of his basic monthly earnings pursuant to the policy, yes.
Mm.
If that wasn't from passive rental income, if that was from wages and salary.
There was never an adjustment. Suppose he's in that position for 10 years, and you issue the policy on year one. 10 years later, when he's now earning $300,000, there's no upward adjustment of the policy of the payment.
There is, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, Unum requests updated salary information.
So that affects the premium too. Raise the premium
or lower the premium, depending upon the income. I mean, incomes change over the years. That's why the evaluation is at the time of the claim.
But
but I just want to make sure in response to one of Judge Bauer's questions, you were saying that there was a list of salary for all of the employees that were submitted, and nobody in your shop picked up the difference, did they? Between the 115 and his salary, because his salary was listed.
His salary was listed as one, no, his income was listed as 115 on that particular list, the one that I'm thinking of. It had all of the, all it had was a number, Your Honor, just an income number. And his was 115, and there were 72.5, and there were various numbers. And based upon those numbers, the total premium for the employer was based.
So given the standard that we're to apply here, I mean, I think you have trouble with the arbitrary and capricious, because given the fact that he's been paying the premiums, wasn't it unreasonable not to interpret it in his favor?
No, Your Honor, because at the time of claim, that's what you look at. You look at how did the company evaluate the particular claim. And keep in mind what we're talking about here. We're talking about a long-term disability plan that provides financial protection for full-time active employees, as it's used in the policy language. That means working for your employer for earnings. The policy talks about performing material and substantial duties, and that is what is protected here. It's not the passive rental income or any other income that may be paid by an employer. Mr. Dingell's argument is essentially, look, I can identify a source of income deemed from my employer. Therefore, my policy definition applies and yours, union, does not apply. That seems to fly in the face of what we're talking about. A common sense approach here is you're protecting people from not being able to work or being able to work. And that's exactly what Newman did here, Your Honor.
The idea is he could get that passive income, the rental income, whether he's disabled or not.
Exactly. What they're protecting is people's inability to perform the material and substantial duties of their occupation. And that's what Unum evaluated here. And the question is, did Unum provide a thorough, reasonable, rational evaluation in this case? And in fact, they did. They spent over a year and a half allowing Mr. Dingell to submit information. They submitted the claim to certified public accountants. They submitted the claim to professional claims people to review. They gave Mr. Dingell, I believe, two appeals. This is certainly a case where they gave him every opportunity to show that his income that he was seeking to gain benefits for was, in fact, covered. Unum disagreed with that. In this case, where Unum has the discretion in the policy, we contend that their disagreement and their interpretation of the policy should be upheld by this court. In addition, Your Honors, one of the other things that we have to look at here is Unum. I see my time is up.
No, you don't. You don't need it.
Okay, I'm sorry. Unum had discretion to not only interpret the terms and conditions in the policy, but also to determine eligibility for benefits. And that was yet another aspect of this that the lower court looked at, and that is Mr. Dingell never really submitted documentation to show the rental income during the claim process. His W-2s, his tax forms, et cetera, just showed the $7,000 a month salary, and he never did show the passive rental income at the time of the claim. So, based upon the thorough evaluation and Unum's evaluation of this claim at the time of claim, not at the time of application, but at the time of claim, we believe that Unum made an informed judgment. It was a rational connection between the issue in this case, the policy, and its conclusion was and should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Minute and a half. I'll do my best to talk fast. First, let me disagree strongly with counsel about what the issue is here, and I'll go back to a couple of other things.
The issue of whether we're talking about the Department of Education, was the company informed of the split at the time the policy was applied for?
Yes, sir. We cited pages in our reply brief of the record. Their application form called for both figures, and both figures were shown. 84 salary, 115 total income. Nothing
was going to show. What did it show the rest of the income was?
It did not explain. Did not explain it, but there was a disparity. Nothing changed between the time of the application and the time of the claim. The numbers, the figures remained the same. Everything remained the same. The test here is not whether Unum went through an appeal process, with all due respect. Mr. Dingo answered every question Unum asked. He gave them all the information they wanted. The test here, under the Cozy case and the other cases, did they contravene the plain meaning of the policy, and did they modify it? The definition is crystal clear. It says gross monthly income from your employer, total income before taxes. There's no ambiguity. Their intent is irrelevant. This is in my humble judgment, Your Honor, an open and shut case of modification, an open and shut case of contravening the plain meaning of the policy to Mr. Dingo's detriment.
Was Mr. Dingo entitled to rental income after became disabled?
In fact, if you go through this long record, and as he told the Unum people, his illness and everything else required him to sell the building very shortly after he left the company. So as a matter of fact, all his income ceased very shortly after he left the company.
And he didn't get the proceeds from the sale?
That I don't know. I assume he must have, but the income, nonetheless, the building was sold.
And there were duties that he had to perform as the landlord.
Absolutely. I mean, you could certainly classify the so-called passive income as income for managing the property, maintaining the property, paying the taxes on the property. He elected to do it, obviously, to split his total compensation in the interest of minimizing Medicare and Social Security taxes. But obviously, duties do go through with that, as we pointed out around the brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both counsel.